Brandon got involved as an officer at the beginning of this semester, and he immediately stepped in and took over our volunteering and charity efforts. Please welcome Brandon to the stage.
Hey guys, I'm Brandon, as you may have heard. I'm introducing Ed Brayton. So Ed Brayton is a journalist and commentator who is the owner of the Free Thought Blogs Network, as well as his own popular blog, Dispatches from the Culture Wars. He specializes in civil rights issues, particularly police misconduct, education policy, and transparency in the government. After spending several years touring the country as a stand-up comedian, Ed turned to writing as the most common outlet for his ideas. He has appeared on many popular television programs, such as The Rachel Maddow Show and The Tom Hartman Show. Ed is the author of the upcoming book, By Their Love, In Defense of Christian Privilege. Today, he will be speaking about the stories found within his book. Ed Brayton.
Pleasure to be here in Madison, Wisconsin, which is a really fun city. And it was the city of my late and dear friend Skip Evans. Are there people, local Madisonians, that knew Skip Evans? Skip was a longtime activist in atheism and particularly the evolution creationism fight. And Skip died very suddenly and unexpectedly a few years ago. Of a heart attack, and he was a really, really great guy, and I was kind of happy to be in his hometown to talk. I'm also really happy to be in the hometown of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which has brought so many lawsuits challenging Christian privilege, and they will be the first to tell you that the stories that I'm going to give to you today about the plaintiffs in these cases are not at all unusual. The threats of violence and intimidation that plaintiffs in church-state cases face is almost in every case. In the research I've done and the people that I've talked to, I've only talked to one person who didn't have a huge backlash from his community, and it was a kid who had challenged prayer at his high school graduation. And in, of all places, South Carolina, the only case I've seen where nobody sent him death threats, nobody tried to harass him too badly. The remarkable thing, when you look at these church-state suits and the backlash that they get, is that it doesn't seem to matter where you are. And when I started working on the book, I sort of assumed that it would be much worse in the Deep South. It's not. No matter what period you're looking at, and I go all the way back to the 1930s, no matter where you are in the country, this pattern has been constant in almost every case. Those who challenge what I refer to as Christian privilege are ostracized, bullied, harassed, often the victims of vandalism, death threats, and sometimes very serious violence. Children have been assaulted, and sometimes their parents too. Homes have been burned down. Families have been chased out of town by the proverbial mob with pitchforks and torches. Now, many of you are no doubt familiar with the case of Jessica Ahlquist a few years ago, which was really the inspiration for me to work on this book. She's a very courageous young lady from Cranston, Rhode Island, who filed a successful lawsuit against her high school because they had a giant prayer mural on the wall of her high school auditorium. There's probably a lot about that case that you don't know, about how her school and her community ostracized and bullied her after the lawsuit was filed. The suit was filed in April 2011 on a Monday. She was 15 years old at the time. A Tuesday morning, she goes to school, and the first thing that they did there was they go to homeroom. And in homeroom, by state law, they recite the Pledge of Allegiance. And so they're all standing up and reciting the Pledge of Allegiance, and when they get to the part that says, under God, all of the other students in the class turned around to face her and screamed it at her. 15 years old, can you imagine how that made her feel? Going to school became an absolutely miserable experience for her, and it got worse when she won the case in January of the following year. The day after the ruling, Representative Peter Palumbo, who is a state legislator who represented the city of Cranston and was actually a graduate of that same high school, he went on a local radio show and called Jessica an evil little thing, you may recall. And he said that taking down the prayer mural was like crucifying Jesus all over again. And that he was tired of Christians just laying down when they're challenged, as if they actually do that. And he and the host actually speculated that this was all done just to make money. That the next thing was she was going to file a $1 million lawsuit against the city of Cranston. I don't know why the city as opposed to the public school, which of course didn't happen. But that didn't prevent them from speculating on this and essentially calling this now 16-year-old girl an evil little gold digger. And this man was her representative in the state legislature. The response to the community was just a torrent of hatred and threats. You know, in the old days, when you wanted to threaten somebody, you actually had to put pen to paper and get a stamp and mail it to them. Of course, Twitter and Facebook has sort of automated that process. So I want to give you an example of some of the tweets and Facebook posts that were aimed at Jessica in the days after that ruling. One young man said, quote, "Hail Mary, full of grace, Jessica Ahlquist is going to get punched in the face." Another one said, "When I take over the world, I'm going to do a Holocaust on all the atheists." The threats became very specific, and some of them came from her classmates at Cranston West High School. One of them said, "What a little bitch, I want to snuff her." Another said, "If I wasn't 18 and wouldn't go to jail for it, I'd beat the shit out of her. I don't know how she got away with not getting beat up yet. This girl honestly needs to be punched in the face." One of her classmates said, "Jess is in my bio class. She's going to get some shit thrown at her. For real, somebody should jump this girl. Let's do it." One young woman tweeted to her, "I hope there's a lot of banners in hell when you're rotting in there, you atheist fuck." And she marked that with the hashtag Team Jesus. Just feel the love. You know, I don't recall the Sermon on the Mount saying, "Blessed are the abusive, hateful assholes, for they shall get many followers on Twitter." But this one is my favorite, just because it's so incoherent. Someone tweeted, "For the record, when you die, you will not grow into a tree or some other bullshit atheists believe in." I guess he told us. I think it's safe to say this young man will not be taking a Rhodes Scholarship away from anyone. But there were literally hundreds of messages like this on Twitter and on Facebook. And some of these hateful people actually went old school and sent them through the mail. And I want to read, this is one letter that was sent to her house, threatening not only Jessica, but her little sister and her family too. It said, "The cops will not watch you forever. We will get you good. Tell your little asshole sister to watch her back. There are many of us crusaders. We have a betting pool going to see who gets you first. Your fucking old man better move or keep you locked up if you know what's good for you. We know where he works, what kind of cars you have, and the plate numbers of the cars. Get the fuck out of Rhode Island, you bitchin' whore. You are nothing more than a sex toy of a slut." I don't know what that has to do with anything. "Maybe you will be gangbanged before we throw you out of one of our cars. We will get you. Look out." Things got so bad that she ended up having to go to school with an armed police escort to keep her safe. And if you happen to bring an irony meter with you today, I suggest you turn it off. Because they don't make them strong enough to withstand the blow that I'm about to deliver. I want to read you what that mural said on the wall of the auditorium. It said, "Our Heavenly Father, grant us each day the desire to do our best, to grow mentally and morally as well as physically, to be kind and helpful to our classmates and teachers, to be honest with ourselves as well as others. Help us be good sports and smile when we lose as well as when we win. Teach us the value of true friendship. Help us to conduct ourselves so as to bring credit to Cranston High School West. Amen." This reminds me of a joke that Jon Stewart used to do before he got the Daily Show and his stand-up act. He used to do a joke where he said, if you think putting the Ten Commandments on the wall of a school is going to make kids behave better, then you probably think that employees must wash hand sign in the bathroom is keeping the urine out of your cheeseburger. Because it's painfully obvious that the prayer on the walls of the school did nothing to actually inculcate those values into the very students who were throwing a fit at the thought of taking it down. Now, as bad as Jessica Ahlquist had it, there are actually worse cases. And the worst that I've ever come across was the case of a woman named Joanne Bell, who filed a suit in 1981 in Little Axe, Oklahoma. In the fall of 1980, her children started talking about something called the Sunshine Club, Sun spelled S-O-N for the Son of God. It was a Christian group that met every Thursday before school started at the middle school. And the club was started by a teacher who said that Jesus personally appeared in front of her and told her to save all of the children of Little Axe, Oklahoma. Now, Little Axe is about 90 minutes away from Tulsa, which is where Oral Roberts famously claimed to have seen a 900-foot-tall Jesus, a vision of a 900-foot-tall Jesus who told him to start his ministry. I don't know whether the Jesus this woman saw was the 900-foot-tall one or the like regular human-sized one. But there were a lot of problems going on here. So first, the teachers in the school were encouraging the kids to attend these meetings and would question kids about why they didn't attend, which of course they can't do. Secondly, on Thursday mornings, the school buses ran about 45 minutes early, picked everybody up early, so that those kids that wanted to go to the Sunshine Club meetings could get there on time. But they wouldn't let anybody into the school if they weren't going to the Sunshine Club meetings. So no matter what the weather is, the kids who had to get picked up early had to stand outside while the Sunshine Club meeting was going on if they didn't want to attend. Now, needless to say, attendance went up when the weather was really bad, which of course was the whole point. Those who didn't attend were aggressively pressured by their classmates. They were called devil worshippers if they didn't go to this club. So Joanne Bell and a few other parents started attending school board meetings and questioning this. And the school board supported the club completely. I mean, just wouldn't budge at all on this. In fact, in the spring of 1981, the school board president told Joanne Bell, you know, we're not going to do anything about this, and if you don't like it, call the ACLU. So she did. Along with another parent named Lucille McCord. And this launched a 7-year battle, which they won, and got this out, and ended with a victory for the plaintiffs. So the school board, in this case, was represented by a man named Bill Graves. He was a state legislator at the time, and he had written a law allowing the Bible in schools. And he represented him in the case. Now, during the initial trial, one of the experts that they called to testify was a man named Rusus John Rush Dooney, or R.J. Rush Dooney. How many people know who that is? Only a few of you. So R.J. Rush Dooney was the founder of something called Christian Reconstructionism, which teaches that democracy is evil and that Christian theocracy is the only legitimate form of government. Bill Graves was a Christian Reconstructionist himself, and he had published articles in the Chalcedon Report, which is sort of the official magazine of the Reconstructionist movement. And though they both argued that there was nothing wrong with the school teaching Christianity directly to students, one of the principles of Reconstructionism is that public schools are evil and should be abolished. So among other things, the Reconstructionists believe that the Old Testament Mosaic law should be the civil and criminal law of the land, including stoning for women who aren't virgins on their wedding day, and gay people and unruly children, and people who break the Sabbath and all of that. And I want to read you a quote. I'm always careful with quotes. So I see people quote stuff all the time where it's just too good to be true. And when you do a little research, you find out it's fake, especially on Facebook. This is a massive problem on Facebook. If you ever see a quote, take 10 seconds to Google it, especially if it just seems like it says exactly what you want it to say. 9 times out of 10, those are going to be fake. This is actually real. I looked it up. And Gary North, who was Rush Dooney's son-in-law and is now sort of the most prominent famous Christian Reconstructionist. By the way, he is also the curriculum director for the Ron Paul curriculum. And used to be Ron Paul's chief of staff back in the 70s. So Gary North has actually wrote an article arguing in favor of stoning as criminal punishment. And he said the great benefit that stoning has is it's really cheap. There's rocks just laying around all over the place, right? So this is a real quote that he said. He said, quote, "So let us be blunt about it. We must use the doctrine of religious liberty to gain independence for Christian schools until we train up a generation of people who know that there is no religious neutrality, no neutral law, no neutral education, and no neutral civil government. Then they will get busy in constructing a Bible-based social, political, and religious order which finally denies religious liberty to the enemies of God." Genuine quote. Now, while all of this was going on in the courts, the Bell family and the McCord family were being treated exactly the way R.J. Rushdoony and Gary North would want them to be treated. The suit was filed in May of 1981, right before the end of the school year, just a few weeks before the end of the school year. Joanne Bell's son, who was in eighth grade at the time, was supposed to receive 7 academic awards from the school. He was one of the best students in the school. And they have an end-of-year banquet in which they give out these awards. After the suit was filed, for the first time ever, they canceled the awards banquet and just mailed them out because they didn't want to give an award to an evil kid like that. But that was just the beginning. So a couple weeks after the lawsuit was filed, somebody called in a fake bomb threat to the school. And Joanne Bell gets a phone call, hears about this. Of course, she does what every parent does in that situation, drives right down to the school, makes sure her kids are safe. She pulls up into a parking space, and when she got out of her car, a school employee, she ran the cafeteria at the middle school, a woman named Corinne Spurlock, grabbed her by her hair, pulled her out of the car, smashed her head up against the top of the car several times, ripped about half the hair out of the left side of her head. She ended up going to the hospital. She had a separated shoulder, a concussion, and a whole bunch of contusions and bruises. While this is going on, the principal of the elementary school was standing about 15 feet away watching it. And after a few minutes, he says, "I think she's had enough, let her go." She was arrested, she was charged with assault, she was convicted. She didn't go to jail. They gave her a fine and ordered her to pay Joanne Bell's medical bills. Not only did the school not fire her for committing felony assault against a parent, they held a fundraising dinner to pay her fine for her. This story is so crazy. As I was researching the Joanne Bell story and I'd interviewed her and I'm looking at articles from the time, like, every time you think that's as bad as it can get, like, it gets worse. So the McCord family raised prize lambs and showed them at the county fair every year. Among the other things that happened to her family, someone slaughtered one of their lambs on their property, which I've always found very ironic, that people who refer to their savior as the Lamb of God slaughtered a lamb to get revenge on this family who had done nothing to hurt them, of course. I think I'm missing something. Ah, there we go. Things weren't any better for the Bell family. Jason, who was in fifth grade at the time, probably got the worst of it. One day at morning recess, another kid pushed him off the swings and broke his arm. The principal of the school, the same one that watched the cafeteria manager beat up Joanne Bell, brought Jason into his office and made him sit there all afternoon. Didn't call his parents. Didn't call the school nurse. Kid sat there in his office crying in pain for hours. Joanne Bell goes to pick him up, and then she finds out what had happened. Takes him to the hospital, and he had a compound fracture and had to undergo surgery that night. And the threats just kept pouring in. I mean, they panicked every time the phone would ring because it was almost always somebody threatening. And they would receive letters saying, we have ways of getting rid of people like you. Probably the creepiest part of this is somebody actually wrote up for both Joanne Bell and Lucille McCord, wrote up an obituary for them and mailed it to them. That has always just seemed to be really, really creepy. And you know, very frightening for them, of course. On September 19th of that year, the obituary almost came true. So by that time, the son whose name was on the lawsuit was a freshman in high school, and he was on the football team. And so the family had gone to a neighboring town where they were playing a football game, and they get to the stadium, and a policeman met them there and said, you better go home, your house is on fire. Someone had thrown a firebomb through a bedroom window, and by the time they got there, it was, you know, nothing but ashes. And again, this just gets worse. A few days after, this was on a Friday night that the firebombing happened. Monday morning, Bill Graves, representing the school board, files a motion in the case to have the case dismissed because the family no longer lived in the school district. Yeah, chutzpah. Word chutzpah comes to mind. The judge said no, he was not going to allow vigilante justice to succeed in this case. But I think this illustrates exactly what this kind of intimidation is intended to do. It's intended to make people cower in silence so that they won't file suits like this. And it works. In that very case, there were originally four plaintiffs, four families that had signed on to the case. Two of them dropped out. One of them was a woman named Carly McGuire, and not long after she had signed on to be a plaintiff in the case, her phone rings one night, and there's a little girl's voice on the other end of the phone, and she says, Mommy? And Carly knew pretty quickly that wasn't her daughter's voice, and then an adult came on the line and said, next time that'll be your little girl, and hung up. The next day, she dropped out of the case. And who can blame her, right? I mean, you want to put your children at this kind of risk? This is what this kind of intimidation and harassment and threats are intended to do. They are intended to keep people from challenging Christian privilege in this way. Now, there's a couple of interesting footnotes about this suit. The first is that the school board thought that Bill Graves was representing them pro bono. He wasn't. After the case got over, he sent him a huge bill, which they were quite surprised to receive. The second is that Joanne Bell, now, Joanne Bell was not an atheist. In fact, her family had built the local Nazarene church. And she had a perfect attendance. She had attended like 20 straight years, never missed a Sunday at this church. The only thing she knew about the ACLU, thought she knew, was that they were evil. Everybody, that's what everybody in her social circle said, right? They hate Christianity. They're out to wipe it out. So after the ACLU represented her in this case, she started volunteering with them at their office. She ended up several years later becoming the executive director of the Oklahoma ACLU. And she retired in 2011. She is now writing a book about her case as well. So yeah, 1990, she became the executive director and served in that position for 21 years. So kind of a good footnote, I think, for what happened. Now, because Christians are safely in the majority, many of them see no reason to worry about the rights of those who are not part of their tribe. But in 2005, a retired Air Force officer who had been stationed at a predominantly Japanese part of Hawaii wrote an article about his experiences there that taught him what it was like to be part of a religious minority. He wrote this as a letter to the editor of a website called the WorldNet Daily. You guys familiar with this? If you read my blog, I hammer them like several times a week. It's an absolutely crazy right-wing website, right? He wrote this as a letter to the editor, and they published it, and it's still on their website. He and his wife attended a local high school football game, and they were not surprised when someone came on the PA system and said, please rise for an invocation. They were surprised to find out it was given by a Buddhist priest. And I want to read you what he wrote as he considered what to do while those Buddhist prayers were spoken. He said, "To continue to stand and observe this prayer would represent a betrayal of our own faith and imply the honoring of a pagan deity that was anathema to our beliefs. To sit would be an act of extreme rudeness and disrespect in the eyes of our Japanese hosts and neighbors, who value above all other things deference and respect in their social interactions. I'm sorry to say that in the confusion of the moment, we chose the easier path and elected to continue to stand in silence so as not to create a scene or ill will among those who were seated nearby." Excuse me. Needless to say, this was our first and last football game. Although many of the students we worked with continued to invite us to the games, we were forced to decline. We knew that if we were to attend again, we would be forced to abstain from the pregame activity. And not wanting to offend our Asiatic neighbors and colleagues, we simply refrained from attending. When placed in a setting where the majority culture proved hostile to my faith and beliefs, I became paralyzed with indecision and could not act decisively to defend and proclaim my own beliefs. I felt instantly ostracized and viewed myself as a foreigner in my own land. We often advocate the practice of Judeo-Christian rituals in America's public schools by hiding behind the excuse that they are voluntary and students who don't wish to participate can remain seated and silent. Oh, that this were true. But if I, as a mature adult, would be so confounded and uncomfortable when faced with the decision of observing and standing on my own religious principles, or run the risk of offending the majority crowd, I can only imagine what thoughts and confusion must run through the head of a typical child or teenager, for whom peer acceptance is one of the highest ideals. I would say in love to my Christian brothers and sisters, before you yearn for the imposition of prayer and similar rituals in your public schools, you might consider attending a football game at Wahiawa High School. Because unless you're ready to endure the unwilling exposure of yourself and your children to those beliefs and practices that your own faith forswears, you have no right to insist that others sit in silence and complicity while you do the same to them. It's a remarkable letter. And I'm trying to find this man because I'd like to interview him for that gets it. He had the opportunity to walk a mile in someone else's shoes and see what it feels like to be a religious minority. As I said, I don't believe that most Christians support this kind of thing, of course. They would find it abhorrent. But there's a small minority that commits these acts. But what you do hear from Christians all the time is they just don't understand why we make such a big deal out of nativity scenes and, you know, manger scenes and Ten Commandments monuments and all that, under God and the Pledge of Allegiance or In God We Trust and the money. They don't understand it, because they live within the comforting confines of the nation's dominant religion and are protected from the concerns of religious minorities and non-believers. They simply can't conceive of the way these things turn the rest of us into strangers in our own country and deprive us of the comforting safety of the cocoon that they are allowed to live in. This is exactly why I think we need to fight these fights. It's also why the growing nature of this secularist movement that we are part of is so important. When I first interviewed Jessica Ahlquist about this, she told me that she had no idea, she didn't know there was such a thing as an atheist movement or humanist movement or any of that. She felt totally isolated and alone. The first person to contact her was J.T. Eberhardt, who worked at Secular Student Alliance at the time, and he emailed her and said, "We've got your back. You're not alone. There's thousands of people out here who support what you're doing." Ellery Shemp, who had been in Jessica's position 55 years earlier as a teenager, taking on what seemed to be the entire world, he started driving to Rhode Island from his home in Massachusetts for school board meetings, just to be there to support her, because he knew, he was 16 when he filed his suit in 1959. He knew what she was going through. Groups like the Secular Student Alliance and the Center for Inquiry began inviting her to conferences where she was surrounded not by people who hated her, but by people who supported her. And in March of 2012, she got an amazing welcome from 20,000 people at the Reason Rally. It was my single favorite part of the Reason Rally was that part. and she was so terrified to give that speech. She got an overwhelming welcome from a lot of people who were wearing t-shirts that said evil little thing, which we had put together by my website, Freethought Blogs. It was actually J.T. Eberhard's idea. He was on our network at the time to make these t-shirts and said, look, if they're going to call her that, let's just own it. And so we started selling these t-shirts and giving all of the money to a college fund that was set up for her. And we raised a little over $10,000 with the shirts. Overall, I think about $70,000 was raised for her college fund. And at the Reason Rally, Hemant Mehta actually presented her with the check, which, like I said, is my single favorite moment of that. That kind of support is really, really important to show these brave young people that the hostility they get from their local communities is not the entire world, that there are people out there who will support them. And that's why I think gatherings like this are very important as well. Organizations like the SSA, CFI, and the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and the AHA here at Wisconsin, that's what these groups are here to do. Because the old saying that safety, that there's safety in numbers, really is true, and at least provides psychological safety, emotional safety, and a support network. Because it's much tougher to stand up to a whole community of people when you feel like you're all alone. So to end, I say let's pledge to continue this. Let's support and embrace these young people, because that's really the only way we're going to break down this system of Christian privilege. And then and only then will we actually be able to have a society that's free and equal. And that is the end. Do we have time to do Q&A? I know you're running a little bit behind.
All right, so we have two options. First option would be to do Q&A with Ed and then take a little 5-minute break. But then we'd start with Andrew and Patrick, the next talk about 15 minutes late, which means we'd end about 15 minutes late, which would cut into dinner. The second option would be to just start Andrew and Patrick right now. So I guess by a show of hands, option one. Option two. Oh God, am I have to count? Okay, option one. Option one.
God is on our side.
41. Okay, option two.
Yeah, I think option one carries it.
Yeah, it's option one. Okay, so we'll do about 10 minutes of Q&A, microphones in the aisles, and then 5-minute break, and we'll get started with Andrew and Patrick at about 4:15. Actually, I have a question. Okay, so first question. The Joanne Bell story, I think we all agree that it would have been a lot better if she had been a Jane Doe in the case.
Yes.
Yes. Are there any cases where it's better to not be a Jane Doe, to actually be open in the case?
One of the reasons I decided to write this book was I want it to be able to be used as evidence in cases like this. And Andrew Seidel from the Freedom for Religion Foundation, he and I have talked quite a bit about this, that the biggest problem they have is people making the initial complaint and they write a letter, but when it comes time to file a suit, they go, my family, and I, who can blame me for giving this history? And so what they frequently do is they will file a legal complaint in the case along with a motion for pseudonymity so they can file it. And depending on which circuit they're in nationally, there's different sets of rules on that. There's actually no provision in federal law about this. So every judicial circuit handles it differently. And every judge handles it differently. So whether you're going to get, you're going to be allowed to file as Jane or John Doe or not depends entirely on that judge. One of the reasons I wrote the book, or started writing the book, is because I wanted to be able to be presented as an exhibit in support of that motion. Say, look, there's a long history of this everywhere. Everybody that tells these court cases gets this kind of backlash. Because hopefully that will convince judges. The other thing that we're going to do in the book is have a piece of model legislation. Not very likely to pass, but the model legislation to amend the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure to sort of make pseudonymity the default in establishment clause statement. So that the judge would grant it automatically
unless there's a really good argument.
So that's the answer to your question. No, I can't imagine anybody not wanting or needing to file a suit under a pseudonym if they're allowed to do so. That helps protect their identity. So.
We all here have heard of Christians speaking of themselves as the persecuted minority, and I wonder if you could comment on that.
It's ridiculous.
Phenomenon.
Yeah. I write about this a lot. It's just that I suppose it shouldn't surprise us that a religion that began with an act of martyrdom, that their followers would want so badly to make themselves martyrs, at least if they don't actually have to suffer. It's much more pleasant to be a martyr when nothing actually does happen to you. If there actually were some persecution of Christians, I suspect a whole lot of them would decide that persecution pose is no fun at all. But they do it constantly, and it's quite ridiculous to see. You know.
Do you have any cases that you talk about in your book where people either felt pressured to dismiss their own cases or they lost whether or not they were supported by the ACLU?
I mean, people lose these cases all the time.
Do they lose the cases more often in the South or areas where there are a lot more Christians, or is it just dependent on the judge?
Andrew probably could address that better than I can. I don't know that that's the case. Different judicial circuits, though. There's 13 federal judicial circuits. Some of them are more conservative, some are more liberal, just depending on who got nominated by which president, you know. So like the Fifth Circuit, which is Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, yeah, is generally considered the most conservative of the 13 judicial circuits. So if you file a case in those, you're less likely to win it than if you filed it in, say, the Ninth Circuit, which is considered the most liberal of those courts. So some of it's just kind of a crapshoot, not really based on geography so much as based on the ideological makeup of the judges in the court. People lose these suits all the time. And so the first part of that question, people withdraw from cases all the time or decide not to sign on to legal challenges all the time because they're afraid of this backlash. And again, who can blame them? If I had children and was in that situation, even as strongly as I feel about this, I'm not sure I would want to put them in that position, you know, of making them an outcast in their school. I mean, that's serious when you got a 12 or 13 or 14 year old kid. Yeah.
I think she was next.
No, he was next.
Oh, okay. Just a quick two-part question. The people who wrote those horrible tweets and emails and mail, were any of them prosecuted either criminally or civilly? And also, was the principal ever prosecuted civilly or principally criminally? Do you know?
The principal didn't do anything wrong that I know of.
Well, it's saying, I think she's had enough. I think she's had enough, meaning he was allowing the beating to take place.
Right, yeah, that was the Oklahoma case. Yeah. Not that I know of. I don't believe there was ever any criminal prosecutions in either one of those cases. In the Joanne Bell case, I think the local police sort of pretended it wasn't really arson, that it wasn't a firebombing when it pretty clearly was. But nobody, I don't think anybody was ever caught. Okay. I don't think anybody in the Jessica Ahlquist case was ever prosecuted, unfortunately.
Thank you.
So at my school, we're reading two books currently. One of them called Speak, another called Monster.
Get a little closer to the mic.
All right. Another one called Monster, and it's basically about a kid who gets told he murdered somebody, even though he was just a bystander. But I don't think it has to do with any atheist, because I didn't read it, so I don't really know. But what I'm trying to ask is, do you think schools should teach more about this to let kids know that this happens throughout everywhere? Because they don't really touch basis on it, anything.
Yeah. I would like to see schools do a lot more teaching on this broad idea, the Bill of Rights. Most schools don't have civics courses anymore. I think they should all have a civics course. I think they should teach kids what their rights are. But that would require that the teachers actually know that material, and they don't, for the most part. I mean, I see teachers and high school administrators all over the country. I mean, this is why Freedom From Religion Foundation is so busy, right? Constantly having things that are blatantly illegal go on. There's a case that they're just getting started on now down in the White Oak School District in Texas, where the principal of the high school every morning gets on the PA system and reads Bible verses. And they sent him a letter, and the superintendent replied saying, basically, screw you. We're going to keep doing it. We dare you to sue us. You know. Now they got to find a plaintiff who's willing to put their name on that case. School administrators are, for the most part, either abysmally ignorant of what the law says, or they know what it says and they don't care, because they've been getting away with it for so long. Nobody's ever complained. We're 99% Christian, and they feel like they're untouchable. And so, I mean, the first part of that would be we educate teachers, and we have to take some pretty strong stands against these teachers and administrators who are willfully violating the law. And I think we need to do that before we expect them to be able to accurately teach kids what their rights are, because they don't think they have any rights.
Hi, I good speech. I enjoy your points. I think a lot of people don't know these stories. I was not aware of these. One critique, though, it seems like you're giving a little bit more, and a harder time to majority religions, but exempting minority religions a little bit. I mean, the case of the example of the guy living in Hawaii, in the Buddhist, that it seems to me that it was his own religious sensibilities that were the problem. I mean, that he didn't want his kids exposed to this. And it seemed like, you know, what, you know, that suggests an intolerance of its own. I mean, what if it were a school board meeting where somebody of a different faith said, well, you can't serve pork because that offends me as a minority religion? And how would you react to that?
I guess I don't understand the point. I mean, is the Christian Air Force officer any different from an atheist in the audience who would be offended by that and say, no, the government shouldn't be doing this? I think it's exactly the same.
Right. So. But it seemed like he's right, but for the wrong reason. I mean, it seems like his own weirdities of, like, you know, being exposed to other things may have something to do with this.
Well, it may, but then, I mean, the legal issue remains exactly the same. Mm-hmm. So whatever his personal motivation was, but I think what he said in that letter is powerful, because he finally realized what it's like to be a member of a small minority amongst a dominant majority religion, which is what atheists and non-believers go through every single day in a million different situations. And that gave him an understanding and a compassion that he otherwise would not have had, because he was safely in the majority religion. So I think it's a powerful example, you know, whatever you may think of his personal motivation.
Yeah, no, the passion is good. It's just, it's interesting, because religion could mean anything to anyone. You know, you could apply this broadly, like, sure, you know, in as far as food choices at some kind of public event. Sure. You'd almost have to accommodate all religions. I think you really can't. You've got to leave it out.
Yeah, this question of accommodation, of course, applies in a million situations, and it's never an easy question. Mm-hmm. Of, you know, if you have a school that's 20% Muslim, do you make sure that you have halal lunches available, or Jewish, for that matter, and kosher lunches? You know, if you have a school that was 25% Hindu, would you make sure you don't serve beef, at least to them? You know, those kinds of questions are always difficult and thorny, but sort of a separate issue from this. So.
I'll make mine quick and brief. These people all seem isolated, these plaintiffs taking on this case. They all seem very isolated, but I'm assuming that in most schools there are more than one or two atheists or secular people in these schools, but because of the social pressures and the desire to conform and be part of the group, they stay hidden in the woodworks. In your experience, have you found any ways to help bring people who may agree with these people who are being ostracized to come together and stand in solidarity within the community, so they don't have to go outside of their community to find support from people that others in the community will see as aliens messing with their own town.
Yeah, they're called SSA clubs or CFI on campus, which Debbie Goddard used to run for CFI. There are clubs that are affiliated with both of those organizations in schools. There's not enough of them. They should be one in virtually every school. And it's really starting to grow. I think they're seeing a lot more of this sort of thing. And yeah, having a group like that, just like having a Gay Straight Alliance club in a high school, provides that system of support right there. And that can help give someone the courage to speak out against that sort of thing. I'm a huge, huge supporter of those, you know, secular student groups, whatever form they may take, whatever organization they may affiliate with. The more of those little communities we build in schools, the better off we're all going to be.
Yeah, I work in a public school, in a high school, and I'm also very interested in promoting secularism. I'm in a very conservative town. I'm wondering if there are any groups you know of that specialize in promoting secularism in high schools specifically, and especially breaking into conservative towns where there may be significant pushback against establishing these kind of clubs.
Secular Student Alliance.
Okay.
Jessica Griffin's got a table right outside. And she'll be more than happy to talk to you about it, I'm sure.
Excellent.
But yeah, they do a lot of those.
Get up, Brad.